big city life as one of the people. You'd like him to get a good education and do well in college. Maybe Columbia. Pick a place. And you would be thrilled if once he'd done it, he'd gone back into the community, gone back to pay back, to do something to advance the interests of the people, his people, all God's people. Wouldn't be bad. I'm a lawyer, my wife's a lawyer, our daughters are lawyers. Wouldn't be bad if he went to law school. But he might as well show that he could do it with the best and go to the best. Okay, there are people who will argue about whether that's Harvard or Yale or other places, but let's take Harvard. That's okay for tonight. And if he was going to go into politics, you'd want him to take the time to learn his craft. No need to jump in at the top, although this guy probably has the ability to jump in anywhere he wants. But you'd like to see him pay his dues, perhaps. Work his way up the political ladder. Be a state or local elected official. Be one of the 9,000 that are now elected of African Americans in public office as a result of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the ability of African Americans to exercise their franchise. And having benefited from that, you'd want him to represent the very best in making that available to others. Oh, yes, you'd want him to speak with eloquence, like the 2004, that electrifying speech to the 2004 Democratic National Convention. But you'd also want him to have the common touch, to be able to touch ordinary people and have them know he cared. And although you'd want him to be strong and impervious to the slings and darts of outrageous fortune, it wouldn't hurt if every now and then he wore his heart on his sleeve, showed that he really cared. And then wouldn't it be great if he went out and won an election going away and was suddenly anointed and recognized for what he is, not just America's new shining present, but for her future. Because as unique as Barack Obama is, his very example will cause others to try to emulate him, to try to do what he does, to learn what he knows, and eventually to stand up. And I gave it away. I can see you're applauding. We now know who that senator is, and he is with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming the junior senator from Illinois, but America's newest and most prominent star, United States Senator Barack Obama. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. That's a nice introduction. I want you to email that to my wife. So she knows what a good deal she got. Now, this is a wonderful evening. It is absolutely wonderful to be at the Joint Center dinner. But before I engage in some remarks, it is my understanding that Louis Martin's widow, Gertrude Martin, who I just had the pleasure of meeting, I understand tomorrow's your 95th first birthday. Am I correct about that? Yeah, is that true? Okay, well, since we already have the Louis Martin Award, and Gertrude is here, and it's her birthday tomorrow, and my understanding, it's become a tradition to sing her happy birthday. And when I get to be 91, I want all y'all to sing happy birthday to me. We're going to sing happy birthday really quickly. So, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Stand up, Gertrude, so we can see you. Birthday, dear Gertrude. Happy birthday to you. Yay. There you go. All right. Fantastic. I also want to say a few words about Muhammad Ali. I'm a big supporter of the Joint Center, but I got to admit, I wanted to see the champ. And in case you think that I'm not serious about this, those who followed my campaign may be aware that I didn't have a lot of artwork in my campaign office. It was a pretty scruffy-looking spot. But the one poster that we had, I actually had two pictures in my campaign office. One was of Abraham Lincoln. The other was of Muhammad Ali standing over that big, what do you call him? I can't call him what he called him, but standing over Sonny Liston, you know where he's got that pose? He got his hook. And the reason people would ask me, why did I have that picture up? And some of it was because of Muhammad Ali's charisma, and some of it was the poetry in motion that he was when he was fighting. But primarily it was the enormous courage and conviction that he represented, and his capacity to defy the odds. And I think that when you think about Muhammad Ali, just like when you think about Eddie Williams, or you think about Dorothy Height, or you think about Togo West, what you see are people who achieve despite barriers, despite hardship, despite hard times. And so that's a reminder to me that no matter what the odds are, we can defeat the odds if we've got it in our heart and in our minds that we're going to defeat those odds. And so I'm just am so honored to be part of any program that's associated with Muhammad Ali. Now, and by the way, one last comment I have to make, and that is about Sweet Honey and the Rock. They gave me CDs as if I don't have your CDs. When I walked in, I've got all y'all CDs. So you don't have to give me CDs, but I appreciate it anyway. You never know. Hey, you never know. We who believe in. There you go. I know all those songs. Now, I want to thank the Joint Center for all that you have done over the years to remind us that the most powerful tools in our democracy are often those that are taken for granted. The freedom we have to speak out when something isn't right, and the ballot we can use to change it. And as Secretary West mentioned, we mark the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act this year. We're also reminded that this freedom and this ballot weren't always so easy to come by for far too many of us for far too long. You know, last month I had the honor of helping to celebrate John Lewis's 65th birthday. It was down in Atlanta. Many of the luminaries of the civil rights movement were there. I had the great honor of sitting between Ethel Kennedy and Coretta Scott King, and both of them turned to me at the same time and said, we're really looking forward to hearing you speak. And that's an intimidating thing. When Ethel Kennedy and Coretta Scott King say they're waiting for your speech, it better be good. But as I stood next to John Lewis, not a giant in stature, but a giant of compassion and courage, you know, I thought to myself, never in a million years would I have guessed that I'd be serving in Congress with John Lewis. And then I thought, you know, there was once a time when John Lewis guess he'd be serving in Congress. And then there was a time not too long ago when people might never have guessed that someday black folks might be able to go to the polls and pick up a ballot and make their voices heard and elect that Congress. But we can't. And many of us are here because of people like John Lewis and people like Eleanor Holmes Norton and people who have consistently feared nothing and risked everything for what they believed in, because they saw injustice and endured pain in order to right what was wrong. And because organizations like the Joint Center saw the nearly 1,500 black elected officials in 1970 and said, we can do better than that, and we will do our part to make it happen. And today there are over 9,000 of us in the United States Senate. That was a wishful thinking there. We could use 9,000 of us in the United States, and we're going to have a couple more in the United States Senate sometime soon. Now, the road we've taken has not been easy, but the road to change never is. You know, some of you are aware of the fact that I teach or taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago Law School, and one of the courses I taught was a course in race and the law. And what was always striking as we chronicled the history of people of color in this country and their struggle to achieve freedom through the courts as well as on the streets, oftentimes my students, black, white, Latino, Asian, would come up to me and they would say, you know, I wish sometimes that I had been around during the height of the civil rights movement, because things seemed so clear at that time. There may have been room for debate about some things, but the clarity of the cause and the need for the movement was crystal clear. And so you didn't have the ambiguities that you have today, because it's one thing to know that everybody should have a seat at the lunch counter, but how do we figure out how to make sure everybody can pay for the meal? It's easy to figure out that, in fact, blacks and whites should be able to go to school together, but how do we make sure that every child is equipped and able to participate and achieve effectively once they get in that school and aren't tracked into some sort of program that will not allow them to achieve? It's easy to talk about dogs and fire hoses when the enemy is clear. But what do we say when we suspect that the enemy may be us, our own young men and young women who are peddling drugs on the streets? It's a lot harder today. That's what they tell me. And I try to remind them that the moral certainties that we now take for granted, that separate can never be equal, that the blessings of liberty enshrined in our Constitution belong to all of us, that our children should be able to go to school together and play together and grow up together, were anything but certain in 1965. That even within the African American community, there was a lack of certainty. There was enormous struggle within our community about the right tactics, the appropriateness of stirring things up. We have a church in Chicago that is on what used to be called State Parkway. And after Dr. King's assassination, it was changed to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. And the pastor of this church hated Dr. King so bad, he changed the address of his church, filed a special petition so that he would not be on Martin Luther King Drive. This was one of the most prominent African-American pastors in Chicago during the civil rights movement. And so it reminds us that it actually has never been easy, and it's never been clear. To get here, it took struggle and sacrifice, discipline, and tremendous courage. And I wonder sometimes when I reflect on those giants of the civil rights movement, where did you find that courage? Dorothy Height, where did you find that courage? Eleanor Holmes Norton, where did you find that courage? When you're facing row after row of state trooper on horseback, armed with billy clubs and tear gas, when they're coming toward you spewing hatred and violence, how do you do it? It's worth examining because the challenges that we face today still require courage. We have many bridges left to cross. The anniversary of the Voting Rights Act reminds us that in America, ordinary citizens can somehow find it in their heart to achieve extraordinary things. And that comes not from violence or the kind of politics that pits us against one another and plays on our worst fears, but it comes from great discipline and organization and a strong message of hope and from the courage to turn against the tide so that the tide may eventually be turned. We need that courage today. We need the courage to say that it is unacceptable to have 45 million uninsured people in the richest country on earth, including one out of five African Americans. We need the courage to say that it is intolerable to tell hardworking families who are earning less and paying more in taxes that we can't do anything to help them buy their own home or send their kids to college or afford retirement. We cannot accept that our senior citizens, after a lifetime of hard work and sacrifice, cannot retire with dignity and respect. And we shouldn't accept arguments that African Americans, because they don't live as long as other Americans, because of disparities in health care, should somehow junk Social Security, upon which most African American seniors depend, and instead we might want to try closing that health disparity gap. We need the courage to say that that's the right thing to do. We haven't come this far as a people and as a nation because we believe that we're better off just spending for ourselves. And that seems to be the dominant philosophy in Washington today, that you're on your own, that you have no obligations towards your fellow man, that you are not your brother's keeper and your sister's keeper. That is what has been labeled the ownership society. I have a different idea of ownership. I take ownership for those children on the south side of Chicago and on the west side of Chicago who can't read and have no prospects of hope. I take ownership and responsibility for the fact that we're creating a deficit that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren are going to be responsible for the bulk of their lives. I take ownership and responsibility for making sure that we're passing on an environment in which our children can breathe and in which they can enjoy the wonderful bounty of this earth. That's the kind of ownership that I'd like to see. And the Joint Center plays a critical role in that process. One of the Washington Post reporters just asked me, what's so important about the Joint Center? And I said, well, if knowledge is power, then the Joint Center is empowering all of us. We can't operate blind. We have to have strategies for change. We can't simply, in pursuit of the same goals that John Lewis and Dorothy Height and all the heroes that have come before us and are still here with us to counsel us, we can't simply replicate the same courage that they exhibited, because the battle lines may have shifted and the nature of the conflicts may be different. Today we may have to fight just as hard to make sure that not only can black and white children go to school together, but that together they can actually afford a college education once they get out of school. And we may have to also challenge some of the aspects in our own community that are encouraging an anti-intellectualism that impedes our children from learning. We're going to have the courage to speak out not only against the dogmas of the right, but sometimes dogmas within our own communities. And that's where the Joint Center can be so powerful, because it arms us with facts, and it arms us with statistics, and it arms us with a strategy and set of policies that we can pursue in order to be successful. But in closing, one of the things that we always need in this process is hope. And, you know, as I reflected on John Lewis and our past, I was reminded of a story that happened to me right after I was elected, I was nominated for the Democratic nomination in Illinois. We had been, as many of you know, the underdogs in this race. And we finally got a little traction right at the end. We had a little bit of money, got on TV. Folks liked what they saw, and we ended up doing pretty well in the primary. But we hadn't had so much money that we could advertise in the entire state, and we had all of southern Illinois, an entirely different media market that we had not advertised. And so the great senior senator from Illinois, now minority whip Dick Durbin, and I talked, and he agreed to accompany me on a 13-city, three-day tour of southern Illinois. And we went to every place imaginable. We went to Murfreesboro and Hillsboro and Collinsville and Edwardsville. We went to every hill and borough and ville in southern Illinois. And there are a lot of them. And one of the places that we went was a town called Cairo, Illinois. Now, you heard everybody kind of murmur. Because for those of you who are not familiar with why the murmurs, back in the late 60s and early 70s, Cairo was the site of some of the worst racial violence of any place in the nation, as bad as anything going on in Alabama and Mississippi during that time. You had an active white citizens council. You had cross burnings. You had segregated schools. You had blacks unable to find work. You had police brutality and harassment. Eventually, you had riots and arson. All the scarred images that are reminiscent of that turbulent time were taking place in this small town called Cairo, Illinois, at the southern tip of Illinois, south of Richmond, Virginia. If you look at it, it is. And so Dick Durbin and I, we're on our way headed down to Cairo, and he turns to me and he says, you know, the first time I went to Cairo, Illinois, I was a young attorney, just out of law school. I had gotten a job with the then Lieutenant Governor, Paul Simon, a great American and a dear friend of mine who helped to contribute to my campaign. But Paul Simon was then Lieutenant Governor. Dick Durbin was a staff assistant, and Paul Simon sent Dick Durbin down to Cairo, Illinois, to try to figure out what could be done to try to improve the racial climate in this town. So Dick Durbin, young attorney, 23, 24 years old, he catches the train down there, or the bus, gets picked up at the station by a local resident, gets driven to his motel. And as he arrives at the motel and he's about to get out, the driver, a local resident there, grabs his arm, turns to him and says, young man, let me give you a piece of advice.
Durbin says, what's that? He says, don't use the telephone in your motel room. Durbin says, well, why not? He says, because the switchboard operator is a member of the White Citizens Council and will report on everything that you say. Well, this understandably makes Dick Durbin concerned, but he's got a job to do. He goes ahead, checks in, goes upstairs, starts unpacking his bags. Here's a knock on the door. Opens the door, and there is a guy standing there. Mean-looking guy. Staring at him. Doesn't say anything. Doesn't give a name. Finally just says, what in the heck are you doing here? And then walks away. Doesn't say heck. And now Durbin's really concerned. And so am I, because we're pulling into Cairo as he's telling me this story. So we're winding through the streets of Cairo, and we take a couple turns, and we come around an old courthouse, and suddenly we come upon a parking lot. And the parking lot is full of people. There are about 300 people there. And as we pull closer, I noticed that most of these people are of an age in which they would have been active participants in one way or another in this epic struggle that had taken place 30, 40 years earlier. But as we get closer, I noticed that about a third of the group is black, and about two-thirds are white. And we get closer still, and I notice they're all wearing these little blue buttons that say, Obama for U.S. Senate. And we get off out of the van, and they're waving and smiling and handing us barbecue and taking pictures. And then Durbin turns to me, and I turn to Durbin. And we knew what the other person was thinking, which is that if you had told Dick Durbin 30, 40 years ago that he, the son of Lithuanian immigrants, born into near poverty in East St. Louis, would be returning to Cairo as a senior United States Senator from the state of Illinois, and that he would have in tow a black guy born in Hawaii with a father from Kenya and a mother from Kansas named Barack Obama, and that he would be greeted as the Democratic nominee for the United States Senate in Cairo, Illinois, folks would have said, you're crazy. And yet it was happening. And yet there it was. Which reminds us of something Dr. King said just a few days after John Lewis had led that march across Pettus Bridge. He said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. It bends towards justice. But it doesn't bend on its own. It bends because each and every one of us, in our own roles, in our own capacities, place our hand on that arc and we bend it. Just a little bit, just slightly. Imperceptibly sometimes. Sometimes it feels like what we're doing as teachers and as activists and as workers and as organizers, it feels like that arc is not moving. It's not bending. And yet, if you step back far enough, it's bending towards justice. And that's part of what the Joint Center has been all about, is helping each and every one of us put our hand on that arc and bending it towards justice. And for that, we thank Eddie Williams. We thank the staff of the Joint Center. We thank Secretary West. And I thank all of you for providing wonderful support to this organization. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.